UK Wine Show, show number 119. Tetra Paks with Tony Sharley. On this week's show, we're talking with Tony Sharley. Tony is the managing director for Banrock Station, and Banrock Station in Australia has been packaging wine in Tetra Paks for 3 years. We talked with Tony about what he thinks of Tetra Paks.
And in the news, Penfolds Grange achieves record price, Hardy's launches half bottles, and Drink Drive survey prompts government rethink.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 119 for the 22nd of August 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Tony Sharley from Banrock Station on Tetra Paks. Banrock have been using Tetra Paks for 3 years, and they certainly have some environmental advantages over glass and performance advantages over bag and box. We're going to be talking with Tony about Tetra Paks and why Banrock Station like them. And in the spotlight, we finish up looking at the history of English wine. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. A bottle of 1951 Penfolds Bin One Grange has sold for a record price of $54,000 Australian dollars, or £25,000, at the annual Penfolds Wine Auction, the highest price to ever achieve for a bottle of Australian wine. The auction was held in Melbourne by Langtons, who say prices for Australia's top-tier wines have never been stronger, with prices for bottles over $500 doubling over the past few years. The 1951 Grange was made by Penfolds' chief winemaker at the time, Max Schubert, and was never commercially released. Only 160 cases were made using Shiraz grapes from Magill and Morphett Vale in the Adelaide district of South Australia. The seller and the owner weren't named, but the bottle will remain in Australia.
Well, I've said it once and I'll say it again. Price of high-end wines reflect the quality of the economy, not the wine itself. And £25,000, that's an expensive bit of bragging rights.
Great. Well, next up, a little bit more conservative. Hardy's have bought out two of its Nottage Hill wines in half bottles. According to research by Constellation Brands, Hardy's parent company, there are lots of frugal consumers amongst us who want to treat themselves to a glass of wine at home, but won't allow themselves to open a full bottle and waste it. Apparently, the new Nottage Hill 375ml bottles will provide a solution. They'll also give consumers who haven't tried the wine the chance to see if they like it, as it retails at only £3.99 rather than £6 on a full bottle. The half-bottle range is available in a Chardonnay and a Cabernet Sauvignon Shiraz blend, and also supports the company's message of promoting responsible drinking.
Cheers, Jane. Personally, I don't think half-bottles will promote a reduction in consumption. We ran a poll a few months ago where we asked people about 500ml size bottles, and I think that's a much more sensible format size myself, rather than 375ml. In general, 50% of people thought they might try it, while another big group of them thought that 750ml wasn't big enough and two 500ml bottles would be just about right. So bottle size is not the answer to reducing consumption, and adding on to that, the shelf spacing will be taken up with smaller bottles. You start to wonder what wine's going to be dropped. The last story is also related to consumption, but it's a good news story, isn't it, Jane?
Well, there's some good news, but there's also some sobering news. The number of fatalities resulting from drink drive accidents in the UK fell last year by 18%, 460 fatalities compared to 560 in 2006. And the number of people seriously injured also fell by 11% to 1,760, but the total number of drink drive accidents rose by 2% to 9,620. And meanwhile, UK motorists could face random breath tests following research by breakdown company Green Flag and road safety charity Brake that shows more women are driving while over the legal limit. Currently, police can breathalyse someone only if they drive erratically or commit another offence. The survey of 2,066 adults found that as many as 42% of female motorists admitted getting behind the wheel while over the legal limit, while the figure for men was 59%. Plans to tackle the problem will be unveiled by the Department of Transport later this year. Don't forget you can get these stories in full at our website 3050.co.uk. Back to you, Chris.
Cheers, Jane. I do like the idea of random drink driving tests. In New Zealand, this occurs all the time. When I lived there, I used to be regularly tested, at least once a year anyway, sometimes even twice a year. Even visiting Australia, I've been checked in random testing stops. But the only time in the UK I've been checked was during a Christmas crackdown where they used the excuse of me going 3 miles over the speed limit as a reason for justifying to pull me over. This is plain stupid. I know stopping and searching is a sensitive issue in the UK, especially after black communities felt victimised by the police for being disproportionately stopped and searched compared to other racial groups. But the result from the police was to put cameras everywhere. Now you're not stopped, just watch 24 hours a day. I'd rather have random breath testing than some other draconian solution. And while I'm particularly careful about not drinking and driving, I have had a morning after a big night where I have been worried when I've been breathalyzed. I felt okay, but you can never be sure. Luckily, I've always been well under the limit. But people often forget that it can take a long time for alcohol to leave your system. And random testing, whether in the morning or late at night, is a great idea. It keeps you on your toes. Bit of a rant there, but I hope random breath testing does come into it. As long as you only get pulled over maybe once to four times a year, any more, and I think it becomes a bit of a chore. Well, last week we spoke with Stephen Skelton, and the spotlight was on his book. This week we're going back to the spotlight on English wine. So this week we're looking at the history of English wine. So, the history of English wine. The Romans grew vines here, so why did beer become the nation's choice of drink? England was introduced to vines and wine by the Romans. The extent to which wines were planted is in some doubt, but sites in Northampton have proved beyond doubt that grapes were grown in Roman Britain. When Constantine made Christianity the Romans' official religion in 312 AD, it cemented the wine production in England due to its religious ceremonies. Wine had to be produced locally because the option for importing didn't exist. However, with the departure of Romans at the end of the 4th century came the death of the vine. But around 596 AD, St. Augustus arrived in Britain, sent by Pope Gregory to convert the inhabitants to a Roman version of Christianity. It is said he probably brought wine with him. With the emergence of trading across Europe, wine from the continent began to be used in ceremonies. There was a modest revival of wine production in England at that time. It was not until the 950s, 50 years after the Vikings were defeated by King Alfred, that vineyards were flourishing again in Somerset. By the time of the Domesday Book, the 11th century, there were 38 vineyards cited. In the 1200s, religious orders were using wine from southern coastal areas of Kent, Sussex, Hampshire, Somerset, Gloucestershire, Herefordshire, and Worcester. However, during the Middle Ages, cheaper imports from the continent put pressure on English vineyards. The remaining vineyards disappeared at the end of the 14th century, when a relatively warm period, thought to be about 1 to 1.5 degrees warmer than today, came to an end and the mini ice age set in. The vines didn't disappear completely, but they did not become a commercial proposition again until 1951, when the first modern commercial plantings was at Hambledon Vineyards in Hampshire. Today, with around 400 vineyards, the majority of which is situated in the southern counties, the most notably being Kent, Sussex, and Surrey, hundreds of tiny boutique wineries with insufficient mass to afford the latest winemaking equipment and making at the very best drinkable, often expensive wines. However, in recent years, a few very large, well-funded vineyards have started to produce good quality and consistent wine. That ends the history of English vineyards. If you recall, I said last week I was heading down to Denby's. Denby's are the largest vineyard in Northern Europe, and I went down there to have lunch with my family and the outlaws. While there, I enjoyed a lovely wet English summer afternoon, but my father-in-law pointed out to me that the podcast with Chris White from Denby's wasn't playing correctly. It cut out after a while. My father-in-law, John, was correct, and if anybody wants to listen to that show, I've reloaded it and it now plays through properly. It's way back in show 52. But next up, we have the interview with Tony Sharley. Hi, I'm here with Tony Sharley. He is the manager at Bang Rock Station in Australia. How are you, Tony?
I'm very well, thank you, Chris.
Excellent. We're here to talk about Tetra Paks. Tetra Paks are a sort of fairly new format for holding wine. Do you want to describe what a Tetra Pak is?
Well, I guess it's a small carton, which is really made largely from paperboard. And Tetra Pak's actually been in the marketplace for a very long time, simply because it's been used to contain other products, such as long life milk, for example.
Is it just pure cardboard, or is it linings inside it?
There are three components to the Tetra Pak. There's what we call paperboard, which is obviously a paper-based product.
Yep.
Polythene, and which makes up about 17% of the product, and then 5% of the actual carton or container is aluminium.
Okay. So aluminium, I presume that provides the oxygen barrier, does it?
It's really a seal for any form of contamination, especially in relation to food hygiene, whereas the polythene gives it that liquid proofing so that it doesn't leak.
Yeah.
And the paperboard, of course, is partly insulation as well as structure, and it's lightweight.
Aluminium is quite good because it is a good oxygen barrier. At the top, where the wine comes out, it's got a plastic type nozzle.
Yep.
Plastic's quite notorious for pouring oxygen through. It's quite porous to oxygen. Is there any sort of protection around there?
Yeah, I think the critical thing is right from the actual capsule itself, which is the plastic cap, right through to the container, it provides the wine inside with a life of about 12 months in pack, uncontaminated.
Yep. 12. Oh, that's not too bad.
Yeah, well, I mean, bag-in-box systems are around about 6 to 8 months, depending on the climate that you're storing the actual product in. That is, if you're going to store it for a while. But certainly the Tetra Pak, Prisma Pak, has a life of about 12 months.
Okay. Do you typically bottle in Australia and ship the packs over, or do you bulk ship them? You know, for a UK consumer with a Tetra Pak on the shelf, how did the wine get to the shelf?
Yeah, it's a good question. At the moment, we're investigating both models. The model we're using at the moment is really based on the availability of the packer and the packing technology. So if you appreciate, this isn't a widely used technology, and packaging plants aren't widely available. So in some cases, we've had to ship wine overseas to have it packed in Tetra.
Yep.
And in other cases, we've had the opportunity to pack some of it in Australia in Tetra.
Which would be your preferred method?
I think from the perspective of retaining control over the quality, obviously having being able to product test and ensure that the product in container is exactly how you want it to be presented to the customer. Having that control closer to your workplace and your winemakers and your technicians, there'd be a leaning towards doing it at home. But I guess as we get more confident with the technology, that won't be so important. The other really important thing to remember here is whether you're shipping wine in Tetra Pak or just in a container before it's actually packaged, the package itself is very lightweight.
And it's also, I noticed it's square. So we're currently at the Climate Change Conference. One of the speakers was saying that 50% of volume and 50% of weight isn't taken up with wine, with normal cardboard boxes and glass. And Tetra Pak seems to be a lot denser in terms of how much you can fit into a box.
I guess it's a very efficient use of space. There's no air, really, between the containers. Because they're square or rectangular, they fit snugly together. So, of course, it's a very efficient form of transport. So if you think of it, as I've described, this very thin wall of a container wrapped around the actual wine means that even when you're shipping it, it's still a very efficient form of transporting a product.
Have you had any issues with the product in terms of failure rates, or what sort of problems does Tetra Pak raise?
It's a good question. In the first instance, we've done a lot of research into Tetra Pak because we're ultimately dealing with a product which is wine, and as you would appreciate, and this whole conference appreciates, and the wine industry appreciates, it's all about presenting the product to the customer ultimately in a glass. So we don't want there to be any change in the character of the wine as a result of the package. Obviously, we do accept that there is a certain life of any product in any container, whether it's glass, tetra, bag in box. But nevertheless, for the wines that we're producing, and I guess the life cycle of our wine, that is that we would expect our wines to be consumed, you know, within or well within 12 months of purchase.
Yep.
There should never be a problem. Now, going back to, you know, history, we've been putting wine, or Banrock Station has been putting its wines into Tetra Pak now for just on 3 years. So we started in the Canadian market of Ontario,
mm-hmm.
Where we use the Tetra brick format.
Yep.
And with a lot of success, we've not had any product failure in that market. And so that's given, you know, I guess, one, it confirmed what we always thought, and two, other wine products had been in Tetra before us as well.
Yep.
Oh,
really?
Yeah. So there are some brands that quite well-known brands, certainly in Canada, like French Rabbit, that have been in Tetra for, you know, a few years before us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in that sense, the technology and the use of the technology had already been in place with wine, that is.
Yep.
And as I was saying, milk products have been using the technology for, you know, 20 to 30 years.
Yeah, sure.
With long life milk and that type of thing. So as far as moving now from the brick format into the Prisma format, which is the taller, more elegant, if you like, type package, we, again, don't see any risk in doing that.
And what happens to the wine after, you know, 12 months or whatever period that the shelf life is for?
Yeah, I guess, you know, all packages have some degree of permeability, whether it's permeability through a cork, whether it's permeability through a bladder,
yep.
a la the bladder in the bag and box, or permeability into the actual, or through the wall of the Tetra Pak. And so with that comes, I guess, the typical oxidation risk, which, you know, we accept is not everything can be stored forever in its pristine state.
Okay, so it's oxygen is the main issue that you've got. Do you have any scalping, you know, or stripping of flavours from the wine? Like, for example, cork and even screw caps do some scalping. Plastics, notorious.
Now, I think they're the sort of questions really you need to take to a food chemist a wine chemist. So it's really, yeah, not my place to comment.
We'll skip that.
Cool.
What was the reason for going to Tetra?
Well, the primary reason for going to Tetra was the research that's been done on the package that says that it's got some very, very environmentally friendly aspects. And because Banrock Station wines have always been at the forefront of, environmental responsibility, not just on our own property in Australia, in the way that we've restored wetlands and woodlands and reintroduced endangered species back onto our property and provided an ecotourism type experience with nature for our wine tourists. We also have conservation programs that are running in 12 other countries where we give a donation for every bottle, or now every pack, that we sell. And we've made a significant investment in global conservation, you know, 70 projects in 12 countries, an investment of, in just in terms of dollar or cash terms, over $5 million. But when you see the multiplier effect of the groups that we're sponsoring and the amount they put in, it's 3 to 4 times more. So what I'm trying to do here is establish the fact that we've always had a commitment to the environment. 2 years ago, we launched a new project in Canada, in Ontario, to actually return the extinct Atlantic salmon back into Lake Ontario. And we felt that this was a perfect opportunity to put our wine into the new format, the actual Tetra Pak, because of its environmental credentials, which we can talk about in a second.
Yep.
But we launched three different wines into the Tetra Pak, and on the Tetra Pak, obviously, there's lots of information about the wine, but we also use the Tetra Pak as a vehicle to tell consumers about the work that we're sponsoring to restore Atlantic salmon populations.
You can print all over it.
Yeah, you've got a lot more real estate on that box
yeah.
or on the pack. So, you know, from that point of view, we felt it was a great way to get our message across. There was no risk to our wine. And, okay, it's now to the package. You know, it is significantly better in terms of its environmental footprint relative to, you know, PET or glass.
What's in terms of what? The carbon footprint, the recycling footprint? Where does it...
Yeah, there are a few components to that that we thought were very important. First of all, let's just talk about greenhouse gas emissions, okay? The Tetra Pak uses four times less or produces four times less greenhouse gas emissions than glass.
Even with a bit of aluminium in there, which is quite...
Absolutely, yeah. And we're talking here relative, we're just talking, this is all consistent, so we're not talking 750 mil versus a litre. This is all standardised data down to, if you like, the amount of package used or produced for to contain 1 litre of wine. So,
is this for a normal bottle glass, not a heavy glass? Not a light glass.
It'd be a normal bottle.
Your old.
Normal bottle, yeah, not the heavy glass. But so if you think, we turn that around. So if we just relative to glass, which is the main form of packaging in the wine industry, and certainly a package that we use as well. But four times the greenhouse gas emissions in glass relative to Tetra.
Yep.
And then the other key component is that when you look at transporting product, etc. And the efficiency of transport, which we've covered to a degree, Tetra actually weighs five times less than glass for the equivalent amount of wine. So there's a weight component here, five times less in terms of weight. And even in, for example, when Tetra Pak are delivered to our bottling lines, to convert them into filled containers, they come as a flat product. Yep. So it's been squeezed, vacuum squeezed flat.
Oh yeah. Yep.
So, you know, when they arrive, we can transport 1 million Tetra Pak containers to our bottling plant on one transport, whereas to transport 1 million bottles to us, which is we use a lot of orders of 1 million bottles also, with Banrock, takes 50 trucks.
Really? Yeah. That is quite good.
So there's an energy component there. And the technology, certainly in Australia and I believe in other countries now too, has got just moved to the point where the Tetra Pak is now 100% recyclable.
Oh, so, really? I wonder about that because with that plastic liner and the aluminium, it's quite a complicated beast.
Yeah. The critical thing to remember here is when you recycle Tetra Pak, we're not recycling it back into Tetra. Okay, so we're recycling Tetra Pak into cardboard-based products, paper-based products, which are obviously still, you know, they're mainstream, you know, components in, you know, in our lifestyle.
Can you recover the aluminium?
I don't know that it's a recoverable product, but it's one of those, because the percentage is already so low, it's only 5%.
Okay.
It's like any perhaps slight impurity in paper or any other product. It's an acceptable component that doesn't, you know, change the life of the new product.
Yeah, sure. I've got you. So you might, the Tetra Pak can be recycled into cardboard boxing or whatever.
Yeah, one of the main uses is actually recycling it into egg cartons.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense because it's a nice low quality cardboard
there.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, excellent. What about consumers' acceptance of Tetra Pak? Because for me, I hate to say it, I am a bit of a traditionalist when it comes to glass. I like glass. I can see that the environmental credentials, and if it's a wine that is going to be drunk quite young, then it sounds like a very good format. But how do you find the consumer taking to it? Do you have to sell it on the back of other environmental issues to get them?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do with a package Tetra is you've got to educate the consumer about its environmentally friendly credentials. So if you look at the new package that we've just launched into Tesco here in the UK, what we've done is we've actually named the pack Eco Mate. So mate being a very Australian thing, you know, a friendly type term, but eco obviously being an environmental positioning. Yeah. And the eco within list the the if you like, the environmental credentials of the pack on the actual pack itself. And you have to remember that we're doing this, you know, at a time now when the world and including wine consumers are becoming more and more aware of the dangers of global warming and what causes it, greenhouse gas emissions. How can we reduce the production of greenhouse gas emissions as a wine industry? We've got to look at moving to alternative packages. So these signals are not just being sent by our company and you know, our brand, Banrock Station, who have got to educate its consumers, but the wine industry is starting to make you know, loud statements about, you know, let's think more about our emissions and let's think about being greener.
So the perception from the consumer, you must have done some market research with the consumers before you released it in the UK market.
Oh, I mean, we've done, obviously, you know, we've had long consultation with Tesco and to get a you know, better understanding of the profile of their consumers and what they're looking for. And this is where, you know, obviously we wouldn't move into this, you know, into this marketplace in a new pack without a level of confidence that comes from the retailer as well, knowing the profile of their customers and the types of signals that they're trying to send to their customers, who are also, if you like, you know, they're competing with other multiple grocers. And so, you know, if being greener and being proactively green is part of, you know, educating the consumer, then we want to be a part of that.
So is it available only in Tesco's in the UK, or?
At this stage, I believe so.
And do they still stock the glass bottle version?
Yes, they do.
And what sort of, yeah, do you know, yeah, roughly what sort of sales?
No, I don't. It's very early days. So I couldn't tell you about, you know, the sales mix, the response, but what I can say is that we launched the product in Australia only 3 weeks ago, and we've had fantastic acceptance of the EcoMate. And I can tell you from first-hand experience, we have a wine and wetland centre in the Riverland of South Australia, where we can obviously offer a wine tasting experience with all of our products that we sell in Australia. And wine in the new EcoMate Prisma Pack container is one of those products. We've had a fantastic response. Consumers think it's a great idea. And one of the other things that they're looking at more than anything is the fact that it's convenient. It's not breakable. So if you're travelling, you've got a container that, one, it holds a litre and it takes up less volume than a 750ml bottle, just as a how much space it takes up in your caravan or your boat or that type of thing. So there's definitely a convenience factor coming in here. People are grabbing it and saying, look, let's take it. Let's have a go at it.
One of the things I liked about the pack was because it's squeezable, you know, you pour yourself a couple of glasses, you can squeeze it closed, get rid of the air out of it.
It's true.
And then put the cap back on, which means that you don't have to have vacuum pumps or nitrogen or anything silly like that to keep the wine away from any air, which I thought was actually a really, really good point.
Yeah. Look, it is. But remember also, this is only a 1 litre unit. So the chances are that two of you, you know, with a couple of glasses each, you know, obviously you're going to consume the contents all in on one occasion, too, which doesn't make a big issue, you know, it doesn't make the storage so much of an issue, if you like. So, I mean, all round, you know, we're really delighted with, you know, moving a wine into an alternative format like Prisma. But we also recognise too that, you know, we've got a consumer who, you know, wants choice, who wants glass for one type of occasion, wants bag in box for another, and hopefully we'll see, you know, Tetra Pak as that other convenient, environmentally friendly package that's, you know, makes you feel good.
Okay, Tony, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thanks very much for your time.
That's a pleasure.
Cheers. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Tony. Tetra Paks do look pretty good, but I'm a bit worried about their recyclability of them. While Tony said they were recyclable, my local council of Richmond upon Thames explicitly state that they do not accept Tetra Paks for recycling. That said, at around a quarter of the CO2 emissions, it's still not a bad use, especially when you consider that recycling of glass uses almost the same amount of energy that it takes to produce glass in the first place. Next week, we're going to be talking with Bernard Segway from INRA. INRA is the French state organisation for research into agriculture, and we're going to be talking with him about why the Northern Hemisphere wine production is so susceptible to climate change. It was the last of my interviews from the Climate Change Conference, And I decided just to have it a wee bit later on because we've done quite a few shows on climate change. Just to finish up this week, we have a quote. Now, I'm not sure who wrote this quote. It is from an anonymous person, but I like the sentiments. I cook with wine. Sometimes I even add it to the food. Right, I'm off to do some cooking. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.